Welcome to the third hour, a Latter-day Saint home study podcast. This season, we're discussing the Hebrew Bible. Our goals? To improve our appreciation of the gospel, to investigate the scriptures more thoroughly, to discuss tricky passages, and to build our faith. Some of our talking points will be familiar. Others will sound new. That's okay. Together, we'll learn something new about the Hebrew Bible, no matter our starting level. Welcome again to the Third Hour Podcast. We're glad to have you. Welcome to episode 42 of the Third Hour Podcast. Elisha. This week we're covering 2 Kings chapter 2 through 13.
Yeah.
I'm your host, Taylor.
Amanda.
I'm Andrew.
Amanda, I can't wait to hear what you did with all these J names.
You are going to be disappointed. Okay, so this week's reading can be divided up into two parts. Elisha, which is nice, and war, which is not. So Elijah is ready to be taken up in a whirlwind. Elisha follows him around, asks to be his successor, and sees him go up in said whirlwind. From there, it's basically six chapters of miracles. Elisha purifies a spring, curses some mean teenagers, and leads some kings to water. Then he multiplies a widow's oil so she doesn't have to sell her children, blesses a woman to have a child, and then raises that child from the dead. Then there's Naaman and his leprosy, and then Elisha doesn't want a reward for curing said leprosy, but his servant does, and the servant gets cursed with leprosy for the affront. That's it. That's the fun part. Now we transition into war by Elisha going full Jedi and levitating some stuff and then spying on the other king's war plans, but not actually being there to spy on them. So then the king tries to take Elisha's city, and we have the famous vision of the chariots of fire. Then the second part of that story, which I have somehow always missed, is that Elisha blinds the army, tells them they're at the wrong place, and then leads them into his people's military, and they're all in captivity. That is a good second half of that story. Eventually, that king comes back, and there's a siege famine. God creates the sound of an army, and the opposition runs away because they think the Egyptians are coming. Elisha prophesies another king, but doesn't do the anointing, and now war. So, to Taylor's great disappointment, I'm going to skip a couple kings because the Bible cannot keep them straight, and they're fighting, but not fight. Nothing really happens. It's fine. So, Jehu gets anointed king over Israel, and he confronts the current, who I am choosing to keep unnamed, king of Israel, and current unnamed king of Judah, and kills them both. Then he has Jezebel thrown from a window, then he kills all of Ahab's house, and then he kills all the king of Israel's house, and then he kills all the priests of Baal. It is really efficient and really bloody, really fast. Despite doing all that, Jehu is still worshiping outside Jerusalem, so he's bad and doomed. The king of Israel, unnamed, is followed by his mother, Athaliah, who tries to wipe out all her grandchildren. One is saved. He's named Jehoash. And by my count, that is the third king named Jehoash in this reading. Those kings I skipped, you're welcome. Jehoash is made king at 7, and his grandmother is killed. He tries to rebuild the temple, but ends up having to give all of his gold to Aram to bribe them out of war. Then he gets murdered and is followed onto the throne by his son. But we backtrack, and he's not murdered anymore, and he goes to Elisha about the war that we just didn't have. And Elisha tells him to smack an arrow against the ground. He does it 3 times, and that's how many times they'll beat back Aram before they lose, and then Elisha dies.
It's pretty exciting stuff.
That was some whiplash in this reading, because I just kept reading the Elisha stuff and like, oh, this is lovely.
I mean, kind of.
Well, but like, you know, it's better things are happening. And yeah. Then it's like sharp left turn back into murder.
I'm actually with you because I actually love the stories of the, I don't always know what we do with them, but I love the stories of the changing of the mantle and the healing of Naaman. Naaman? Mm-hmm. How do you say it? I don't know.
They both really resonate with me. Like, the mantle resonates with me because of this sense of wanting to believe that, like, you know, things worked out for my ancestors, right? They had hard lives, but things worked out. And, like, I want to believe it's going to work out for me. And this sort of, like, sense of, like, the transfer of God's care, right? And with Naaman, like, I just feel like I resonate with the idea that we often reject good solutions to problems if they seem too easy for us or too, I don't know, simple. Yeah. Although I have mixed feelings. Again, it's what you do with it. Because I do think in my life, a lot of times, like, the answer is simple. Like, I need to meditate more or something like that. But then also, I feel like we use that same scripture to justify, like, I don't know, sometimes simple answers to complex problems actually aren't the right thing. Anyway, but I resonate with those stories, and it is kind of whiplashy, like you say, to, like, oh, this is, I really resonate with this. And I'm like, oh, he just killed kids for making fun of him.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, have you guys seen the internet meme on that one?
No.
I'm indebted to Reddit for the following impression. Are you ready?
Yes.
Elisha was a prophet, didn't have much hair. So the children teased him, said his head was bare. Then came out the grizzlies, ate them through and through. If you mock the prophet, bears will eat you too.
Nice.
What subreddit are you on?
Someone showed it to me. This is what subreddit they were on. I think it was the ex-Mormon subreddit. But
Kansas, see, my point still stands, sir.
I think we should all sing it.
I liked it because when I got taught this lesson in primary, that was the takeaway. I still remember it.
Oh,
like, the teacher trying to, like, say, well, no, like, they were being really rude. As if that somehow justified it.
Anyway. Bear. Two very hungry bears.
So thank you, someone on the internet, for that extra verse.
I do not thank you.
They were all over the age of accountability, Taylor.
You're right. That justifies it.
Yeah.
Sometimes I forget what different experiences we had growing up in this religion. And then stuff like this happens because, like, I don't know that story. I've never heard that story.
Can you believe? I don't actually know how old I was, but I remember getting a lesson on this and, like, that being the focus of the lesson.
I didn't get that part. I think the only bit of the Elisha story I am familiar with is Naaman and the first half of the Chariots of Fire. And only because of that one quote, those that are with us are more than those that are with them. And we never talk about the second half where he just, like, it's an entirely different approach to people than Elijah's approach. But I figure we'll get there.
That's true.
And, like, the killing
it's of kind of refreshing, actually.
Yeah, the killing of the 42 children seems super out of character with everything else that happens in this story.
Yeah.
I mean, the way that we are choosy in these narratives, I think, is just so fascinating.
Yes.
So one of my big impressions is just the way that this narrative is in tension with itself. So you may have noticed that the Lord lost a war.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To another god.
Like, yeah. And it's like, just says it.
Yeah.
Well, it says it in the NRSV. And even then, it's a little, my footnote hedges which direction it could go.
Oh, really? My footnote was like, no, that's what it says.
Yeah. No, my footnote split that baby.
Yeah, so even in most English translations, there's just no getting around the fact that Chemosh wins that war.
Yeah.
And the prophecy that Elisha offers just utterly doesn't come true.
Right.
Now, we've seen that prophecies, that we have to have sort of a different idea about prophecy, because we've seen plenty of prophecies that kind of don't come true the way they're foretold, but they kind of come true in the, you know, spirit of the law.
Yeah.
Not here. So,
not the spirit of the sins of the father's law, though. I mean, it's often like, yeah, you're guilty for your grandpa's doing, that's why you're getting killed.
Yeah, he didn't get punished.
Yeah.
He did the thing.
Well, should we jump into the text? Any other impressions before we dive in?
Are you sure?
So we start, we have to wrap up with Elijah first. Mm-hmm. He gets taken up in a chariot of fire. Yep. Mm-hmm. Swing low, sweet chariot.
Inspires a lot of art.
Yeah. Anything else we want to say about it?
It just, I think it fits the tone of the folkloric.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, most of these things, I think it's just so interesting how that has captured the imagination And yet it's bookended by such absurdities. I don't know. I just think it's so interesting that that's one of the things that we take out of this text is like, Elijah will return. He was taken up. And then you look at either side of it and you're like, oh, this is kind of like silly stories.
Yeah.
Some of these.
Yeah. It's fascinating to me how long that's been going on though, right? Because we see that like in the Old Testament, that idea starts coming up, right? Or is it not till the New Testament?
No, it's everywhere.
Yeah. So it's fascinating. I just don't know what to do with the Elijah story. That was kind of my impression last time too. Like, why is this guy so important?
Yeah.
And I think you're right that this is part of the reason. Like, we get really fascinated by this idea. And the text is fascinated with it too, right? Like, all the other prophets want to go look for him. God must, what does it say? Like, God must have dumped his body in some valley, basically. We should go find him.
Yeah. Well,
they think that maybe God moved him somewhere, but not that he actually, like, was taken somewhere, like, heaven.
Right.
This is fascinating just from like a theological standpoint, because we're finally getting an idea of the development of a good afterlife.
Yeah.
that someone could be going to be with God as opposed to God basically being like a rock that comes around with you or a cloud, you know, that it's really changing its perception of who this divine being is and where he inhabits and what he's all about. It's totally changed here.
Yeah.
So kind of interesting that we're seeing that development now.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. Do we have a sense in this part of the text, or I mean, this is all we're thinking post-exilic, right?
Yeah.
So do we think that development is happening post-exile, or do we think it's calling on development that happened pre-exile?
We're thinking that what this is principally post-exile. And what it is that after the exile, that it's even after the like Persian overlords have been displaced by the Seleucid kingdom, the empire. And what it is that the Seleucids, who are the Greeks, so they're the successor state of Alexander the Great. He had a general, Seleucus, who was one of the successors when Alexander died as a very young person. One of them was Ptolemy, which is why we get the Ptolemaic dynasty in Egypt. But we have Seleucus, who kind of controls Anatolia and Syria. And the Seleucids are not very nice overlords to the Jews. And there is, in that time period, a very difficult reckoning that the Jews are going through, because they're saying, well, so Seleucus Antiochus, this brutal overlord and the dictator at the time of the Seleucid Empire, who's coming in and openly defiling their temple and making it so that they can't worship, outlawing the Jews. This is the time period that Hanukkah comes from, right? That they're going to liberate Jerusalem, and there's not enough oil for them to keep the lamps burning. But then there's the miracle when the lamps keep burning. That's that time period. Well, in this time period, there's a theological conundrum, because they all believe that death, everyone kind of goes to the same place. But in their imagination, they cannot conceive of going to the same afterlife as Antiochus, because he's so awful to them that why would God send everyone to the same place? So they start to develop this notion that heaven is sorted according to something. Now, heaven is not sorted according to goodness. It is sorted according to covenant. And this is where it starts coming in, that kind of everyone goes to shade place, but if you're in the covenant, you're redeemed to heaven. And these are just super quick and dirty terms, right? But that if you oppose the covenant, maybe you go to extra bad place. And so we start seeing this notion of one place, just Sheol, the pit, start peeling apart into very distinct strands. And it arises because of a political necessity that their identity is under fire from an external force. Now, that can't develop in this time period, because they're not under fire from an external force. It's all internal. Everyone who's fighting and persecuting each other are in the covenant.
Even like Aram and
I mean, no, they're not.
Yeah,
but they're not very important. I mean, they're not dangerous the way Jehu is or the way Jezebel is, you know. So kind of the big threats are all majorly internal here. And so that theology just really doesn't exist yet. And that's pretty consistent with the way that other Near Eastern religions begin developing in that time period as well. So important, that's one of the ways that kind of helps us date this, actually. We have a lot of other ways that we're dating this, so don't think that's the only one. But it does help us get a sense for the way things are developing in reality as opposed to just what the text is saying. So this is very much a retrojection.
Well, now that you pointed out, it kind of feels like a retrojection. I mean, like you said, there hasn't been any sense of even really, there hasn't even really been a strong sense of afterlife at all. I mean, there's been kind of this vague sense of a sleepy kind of afterlife.
Yeah, there's the pit.
Yeah. Interesting. I like reading. It's fun to see the development like that in the text.
It is, yeah.
It's really interesting.
When we've seen the way that God has gone from being incredibly local and tethered to objects and, you know, like his big miracle is like, well, I'll go with you into Egypt, which is like shocking. And now he's becoming really universal. He's impersonal. He's not like a being walking around in your neighborhood. He occupies a space that is other than here.
Yeah.
And it's not just the clouds even, right? It's a kingdom above the clouds. So really fun to see. Where it causes us to stumble is how literally do you take the text? I mean,
yeah.
And to be fair, this is incredibly hard. So for instance, so what does Elisha do? So Elisha immediately repeats some of Elijah's miracles, right? It goes back across the River Jordan, makes it part, and then does some of Moses's miracles, like sweetening the water. But also then like the she bears thing happens with like tearing up all those kids. And even early rabbinical commentators are clearly aware that some of this story must be embellished. Like they don't like that story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so even though they leave it in, they try to like bend it. So it actually becomes like an early Hebrew idiom to say neither bears nor forest. To basically that stand in for like, this is a fake story. So if I come and I tell you a big fish story, someone might say, well, there's neither bear nor forest. And that idiom directly derives from this story here in 2 Kings 2, because even rabbinical commentators were going, you know, who are incredibly credulous by our standards. they're invested in believing this. And even they're going like,
yeah.
Some of this is, you know.
I wish they told my primary teacher.
Well, I don't want to cast them as more credulous than a primary teacher. And it's not just rabbis, right? It's everyone. But
that's a fact. That's been kind of an impression of mine. If you're at all serious about trying to learn something about the way God works with humans in this text, like sorting through how to think about that becomes just, it's insane. Because you have to be so choosy. Then you end up just choosing what fits with your already existing worldview. And then what's the use?
Yeah, this thing is like a walking example of a proof text, because there are all sorts of places in here where you can pull out some sort of silly moral lesson that's very simplistic. Mm-hmm. Like, so the story, and we'll get to this, where someone doubts Elisha and then just like dies.
And then gets trampled to death.
Yeah.
And so is the lesson like, don't doubt? But like, isn't that the only person in the story who has like a real world perspective on any of this? Like, You can pull out simplistic little stories, but in order to do that, you have to leave out the fact that this is like incredibly complicated house interfighting dynamic.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Like it's so complex that everyone ends up proof texting out of this to prove whatever is comfortable to them.
Right. So then we're on to Elisha. He heals the water, like you said, curses the teenagers. I guess we kind of talked about that. And then there's this, I just loved this story. Okay, so we have the battle. Israel, Edom, and Judah team up to fight Moab. And we've kind of hinted at this already. Elisha provides water for them. And this is where he predicts that they're going to win the war.
Right? Yeah.
Elisha says, you know, you're going to beat Moab. And they almost do. They've got him on the ropes. He's in his like last stronghold and in desperation sacrifices his own son.
Mm-hmm.
And that part's less fun. And then I'll just read the text. When the king of Moab saw the battle was going against him, he took with him 700 swordsmen to break.
You're
just looking at 27.
To break through opposite the king of Edom, but they could not. Then he took his firstborn son, who was to succeed him, and offered him as a burnt offering on the wall, and great wrath came upon Israel, so they withdrew from him and returned to their own land.
That was 3:26-27.
Yeah. Yeah, and my footnote just is pretty blatant. The great wrath originally referred to the wrath of Chemosh.
Yeah.
Who responded positively to this human offering by decimating the Israelite army.
Is that where your footnote stops?
No, but the biblical redactors probably understood it as a kind of disgust that repelled the Israelites.
Okay.
But that's, at least here, it seems to me like they're saying the biblical redactors were wrong, is clear.
Yeah, so this is
certainly the simplest way to read it.
Yeah, so this was understood for centuries to be that Chemosh won the war.
Yeah.
Because the sacrifice offered by Chemosh's people empowered Chemosh
right.
to beat up Hashem.
Right.
When did the change happen? Do we know?
If you look at old Talmudic commentators, you can find anything, right? Like, there's always going to be people who are Orthodox and want to create an excuse. But Christians just cannot handle, even early Christianity commentators, they just really struggle with this idea that there was ever any God other than this God who basically became Jesus.
Well, the King James Version has, and there was great indignation against Israel, and they departed from him and returned to their own land.
Yeah. So people kind of, like, that's interesting because you can tell that there's really no fixing the text.
Yeah.
The best that they can do is kind of like pretty it up. So yeah, it's like
soften it and make it a little opaque.
Yeah. Yeah. And like word choice it. So it sounds like we want nothing to do with you people. We're going home.
They muddy the waters.
Yeah.
Even the problem is that even that, so the prophecy just was utterly untrue.
Right.
I mean, you could probably do some like, well, all prophecies are contingent, and like maybe the soldiers in the army weren't strong enough to get past their disgust. It's just you got to do such pretzel turns to make it
mm-hmm.
anything other than what it plainly is.
Yeah,
and which goes along with like the tribal politics and the traces of polytheistic gods we've seen all over the place.
Yeah,
sorry, Taylor.
Well, no, I two thoughts on that. One is, it's really counterintuitive to me to try to make an argument like that, because everywhere else in the Bible, the correct response to like the worship of the wrong God is to attack. Like, it's not, you don't run away in disgust. You execute the ban.
Yeah.
Right. But then the other thing I was going to say that kind of brought on by your comment is just, again, it's really fascinating to see this development and the ways in which the text keeps poking at the development and sort of poking holes in the new narratives that people are trying to tell.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting.
Well, and that's part of the Naaman story, right? Is that we get this Naaman guy, and we'll get to him in just a second, of course. But like, he's like, well, I'm going to fall. I guess your Lord is the only Lord. And it's like, yeah, except this Lord really just got his hiney handed to him by like Chemosh.
Well, and even in that story, the Naaman's like, so I better take some dirt from Israel with me back to where I'm going so I can worship this God, which is like, if he's a universal only God, why do you need Jewish dirt?
But also, I'm going to continue to go to the temple of my boss, my king's God, and I hope your God won't get mad at me when I kneel and pray to him too. But just so I don't get in trouble at work.
And Elisha's fine with that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so what we're likely seeing is, kind of like with the Elijah stories, is that these are likely oral traditions. And some redactor from way later is trying to layer over his much more developed theology over the top of it and not really being able to paper over the stucco all the way. Right. Yeah. So you can still feel the textures through the wallpaper.
Right.
And in some places it just totally pokes through.
Yeah. Some places you're like, whoa, there's a hole there. Yeah. That was my reaction to this, was just like, and that's why I enjoyed it. I mean, it's just fun to see the tension there.
Well, and it's sometimes I forget how much learning we've done over the course of however many episodes we've been through.
41.
Ugh, merciful heavens.
In the 42nd.
Because, like, if I didn't know all the things that I knew and had all these conversations that we've had about blood gods and tribal warring, you would absolutely just be able to go, yeah, they were so super offended that they just, they picked up their ball and went home. Like, it would be super easy to see that if you didn't have all of that information.
Yeah. I love that thought, because can you imagine this being week one?
Yeah.
Just like, what the heck?
So then we're back to Elisha. We don't get much commentary on that failure.
No.
Like all of a sudden.
But it makes you wonder if the redactor just removed like a paragraph of conversation of Elisha scolding people for failure to whatever, whatever religious commentary could have happened, but that would have made it clear. And so the redactor was just like, da da da, snip, 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 moving right along.
Yeah. That comment actually makes me think, though, how much this is in contrast to the story of Elijah.
Yeah.
Where you've got like this battle between Baal and Jehovah, which is basically supposed to show that there is no Baal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is just so like radically in tension with that story.
Well, and one way you can kind of square it is that it makes sense because that was an internal dispute, right? We're working basically with Canaanite religion, and now we're stepping outside of Israel. Like, so you can make that story go however you want it to go. Whereas this battle between Moab, like we have Stele, like attesting that Moab was like winning, right?
Wow.
And so like they can't really escape the fact that Chemosh beat Hashem. So I guess they just sort of blip it, you know?
Yeah. All right. Now we're really moving on. So Elisha meets this widow, provides a lot of oil for her so she wants to sell her kids. Is there more to say about that? There's just like this list of miracles now that we're going to run through.
So chapter 4 is 4 miracles. And bottomless oil. She has a son. First of all, the son is
the result different, of this though, prophecy. Right? The bottomless oil is a widow, and then there's the Shunammite woman who's yes. different, right?
Yeah.
And so he says, oh, you'll get a son. The son dies of like heat stroke or something. And then Elisha raises him from the dead.
Through totally different means than we've read about before.
Yeah.
There is no laying on of hands here. This could not be more.
You're right, because this could be the story of a local healer.
Yeah.
That got blown out of proportion.
Yeah.
Well, and like, it reads almost like I can't remember the name of the movie, but like where you're witchiness, I'm going to take my life energy and give you life energy instead of like God is going to raise you from the dead. I'm going to take a piece of me and put that in you.
Well, you know, that's how mouth-to-mouth resuscitation was in a sense understood. In some of the earliest times when we learn about that, is that because isn't it that you're giving them the breath of life literally the way God did?
Yeah.
And so it's easy to see how like a common healing person medical practice, like if someone dies and it's kind of like not a trauma that killed them, and you're like, well, I guess their system took a shock, so I'm going to breathe into their chest, into their mouth and do chest compressions or something. You can see how like it would just seem like a transference of life energy. We know that's talked about in other places. Why not here? And then it just turns into this big Elisha story like everything else does.
Yeah, I mean, my footnotes even just say, crouching over the boy's body suggests a magic ritual in which the properties of the living party were transferred to the dead.
Yeah, I mean, the way it describes it, right? Putting his mouth upon his mouth, his eyes upon his eyes, his hands upon his hands. I have a certification to do this. Most of us probably have had to do this.
I had one once. It's not active.
Yeah. This is not current best practice, right? Yeah.
It's I know enough that someone else can be dialing 911 while I panic and breathe.
Yeah. Well, and it's like, okay, clear the airway, Elisha.
Yeah. So there's those two miracles, and there's the poison soup and the multiplying of food in chapter 4 as well.
Yeah.
And then the healing of Naaman, which I feel like is a famous story that our listeners will be very familiar with.
Mm-hmm. Except for the ending.
Yeah. But like you, Amanda, found that
second half of the story of Naaman.
Yeah.
Well, we pretty much, why should we read past the punchline, right? Which is like, well, God asks you to do simple things, so do them.
Yeah.
Like, that's a great punchline. But then it goes on like, well, I guess I got to box up a bunch of soil.
Oh, well, and like, God asks you to do simple things, so do them. And then let me have a paragraph about the incredibly complicated way in which he is going to continue worshiping God, but also continue to worshiping the God of his country. And then
have like a transference of leprosy. Yeah. Like, for some reason.
And that he wants to pay Elisha. And Elisha's not cool with that. And then Gehazi, who is Elisha's servant and has been and seen all these miracles throughout these chapters, and now he wants some money and some clothes. And like, what a low bar, friend.
And yeah, like, swindle this guy for half his kingdom.
Yeah. And then like,
you can do better than this guy.
Come on, Gehazi. Show some hustle.
It's...
Maybe Elisha would have been okay with it if he gotten more out of it. He's
like, you know how we need a house for the entourage of prophets?
Yeah.
Well, I got half of Naaman's household.
Like, oh. But it just, it really does keep going on for the same amount of time, like the same page space as the story of Naaman that we talk about. And then there's a whole second half of that story in the same chapter.
Yeah. And then it gets really silly.
Making the axe float?
Not only that. Like, chapter 6, the whole of chapter 6, I'm like, alright, now we're just into, like, Keystone Cops mode. So the floating axe head is kind of like, oh, that's cute. That's fine. But then there's the invading army,
mm-hmm.
where he's like, okay, I'm going to make him blind, and then I'm going to lead the army. How is he doing it? Are they, like, in a conga line?
Well, and, like, is some part of the god being involved that they're willing to just follow around this old man?
Hijacks their agency temporarily. Yeah. That's a really nice Mormon theological fit right there. Yeah, no, it's bad. I do get a kick out of trying to imagine the whole army just being like, sure, let's follow this old guy.
Yeah, that we can't, yeah. And I didn't even think about that. Like, are you holding onto the shoulder of the person in front of you?
Yeah, this is not like a nice level field.
No.
You know, rocky terrain.
How far do we have to camp? How far away is this?
Yeah, do any of them trip and need, like, help? What happens here?
Yeah, it's a strange story. But I love that it doesn't end in massacre.
Yeah, and, like, that's part of the strangeness.
It's true.
I was all prepped for that. And then...
Yeah, that's totally what you're expecting after Elijah.
Yeah.
Like, he killed a lot of soldiers for much less than this.
Yes.
And they were Israelite soldiers. This is Aram, right?
Yeah, so Aramean.
Well, and so we're in 6, and this is verse 20, around 20 is where it starts, and we're taking the hobbits to Isengard. And then in verse 22... the king is asked, so do I kill him? And then Elisha's all, no! And mine has an exclamation point.
Yeah, mine too.
No!
Did you capture with your sword? It's like food and water. Yeah.
And let them go home. Let them go to their master.
Unfortunately, it doesn't work.
No.
Like, I love how it's like, and the Arameans no longer came raiding into the land of Israel. Sometime later, King Ben-Hadad of Aram.
Well, and he lays siege to it, and the famine is so bad that we talk about eating our mothers eating their children.
Oh, yeah, it was a really disturbing.
Yeah, like we went hardcore on how bad that famine is, which tells you, in theory, how long it was. And so part of you is like, now, so either Elisha made the worst possible choice. Or, like, where's the profit in this? Where's your oil now, sir?
Yeah, I feel like that's one of the things that really jumps out at me about all these passages, actually, is there's clearly this, some version, I mean, I hesitate to call it prosperity gospel. I think it's a little presentist in a way, but there's some version of that way of thinking about the world, right? That if they're doing what Jehovah asks, if they're doing what the spokespeople for Hashem, I guess I should say Hashem, anyway, if they're doing the right things, then that's when the kingdom prospers. But there's all these times over and over again where that's just not what happens. It tries to tell you that a king was really good, and then it's like, footnote, he lost all this territory. You know, like, and it's just constant. And like you say, here it is. Like, they tell you he got it right. The Arameans no longer came raiding. And then they're in a famine so bad they're eating their children. Text is just, it's wrestling with itself on this point all the time. And I'd really like to meet the redactors and understand if they had some kind of nuance in that view that I'm having a hard time seeing so much later, or if they just, I don't know. It's fascinating to see how much the text is interfering with their agenda.
Yeah.
Well, like, it makes you wonder, was the first redactor really good at this and did a great job? And then redactor number two was trying to deal with the first redaction and he's not so great. And then, like, we're on redactor, like, number seven now, and he was just, duh, 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 I'm going to scribble out that part, and then I'll skim that part. I got places to be. Like, who was bad at this?
Yeah, and we can tell that this is multiple authors. Like, it's super apparent, especially if you read it in Hebrew. Like, we go from, like, this kind of overview sketch of what happens into, like, this siege of Samaria by Ben-Hadad with like intense detail and like really evocative detail. Like it talks about the cost of like, you have to pay all this money for like a donkey head, right? Or a cab of dove's dung, which could be fuel, you know, but it could also be implying that they're paying to eat dove dung because they're so desperate. They're eating children.
Yeah.
And like, so all this detail and really the language is super evocative. And it wasn't like five paragraphs ago.
Yeah.
So it seems like we're seeing so many traditions and ideas and stories just stitched end to end. And sometimes there's deep artistry and sometimes there isn't.
So Elijah predicts the end of it. And as we said, one of like the captain of the king's host doubts it.
Yeah, because he makes a ridiculous statement, right? He's like, tomorrow you'll be able to buy all the fine flour. You won't even be eating dove's dung tomorrow.
Yeah.
And he's like, come on.
Yeah. Even if God literally opened up windows and started throwing stuff down, is that really, like, would it change that fast?
Well, also, it takes some time to grind your flour.
Yeah. But of course, but this prophecy is fulfilled because they raid the enemy camp after the enemy, and as you said, they think the Egyptians are coming.
As a side note, whose job was it to stand on the wall with a telescope? Or whatever ancient version of a telescope we have, and keep an eye on the enemy camp and didn't notice that everybody had left.
Yeah, like, this whole story reads like someone is writing it who doesn't understand how military campaigns work on either side.
Yeah, they're an artist. They're into the individual drama. I mean, this story is so, like, it elicits such an emotional response. That's what this person's good at.
Yeah, there's no scouting on either side.
Right.
So like Amanda says, there's no one on the wall of Samaria like, oh, look, they're leaving.
Yeah.
There's also no one in these Arameans camp who is like, well, let's see, is an army coming? We've got like hundreds of scouts out in the countryside. This idea that two armies just like bumble into each other doesn't happen, right? You project out a scout force and they return and tell you what's going on. So you are informed. So this is just such an unserious perspective on what a military campaign would be. Like, they're besieging a city. Of course they're going to send out scouts because in part they would be anticipating a relief army.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm scoffing in my head. And then legitimately this afternoon, my niece was watching something where one of the teenagers on this terrible Nickelodeon show had to like give blood for a play or something, and they kept getting it wrong, so she ended up giving 3 pints of blood in the episode, quote unquote. And I was all, that's not accurate. That's not how the I've done enough murder research for stories that I know there's something wrong there. So I made her pause it and Google and like, oh, that's half of her blood mass. She'd be dead. And so like, even now we have Google and we don't Google things. So I scoff less at this guy who's probably never been out of the city being like, and then the army just vanished. And the lepers who happened to be outside, like, you know what? You could write for Nickelodeon.
That's kind of what I mean by pointing out that this author's good at the emotions.
No.
I mean, this is a great story, right? You've got the marginalized lepers, like the losers, mm-hmm. right, out in between these two armies, who are like the fortunate ones to sort of stumble on the scene. You've got the women and the even their children. I mean, mm-hmm. that's obviously really evocative, and the way the king is behaving. And I actually think there is a lot of artistry to this story.
No, absolutely.
It's just not.
Yeah.
It just doesn't understand militaries.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, really fast. So that's kind of, and then abruptly that ends, and we're back to the Shumanite woman. And I'm like, it's not clear to me if this is like bouncing back, and she was gone for this whole thing. She's warned to flee because of a famine. I don't know if it's this famine.
I assumed.
Comes back and gets all her property back, and her lost wages.
It's always nice when, like, it was such a delightful surprise to have her story come back up again.
Yeah.
Like, we talked about you chapters ago. That's nice.
And it ends well for her.
It does.
So many of the women that get named, and she doesn't get named. Maybe that's for the better in this case.
Well, and I appreciate that back when Elisha was all, you'll have a kid, and she was all, don't you mess with me, man.
Yeah.
I don't care if you're a prophet. Don't you mess with me. And then she has the kid, and the kid dies, and she hunts down the prophet, and like, what did I say?
It's actually, I'm glad you bring that up, because it's just another place where this text is in tension with itself. Because how do you interpret that response other than being a little bit doubtful? And she's not condemned, but this captain is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The response isn't that different. Anyway. So then Elisha gets involved in some politics. First, he engineers a coup in Aram, right? It's in Aram.
Yeah.
Did I get that right?
And not only is it a coup, remember, this is he's fulfilling the first of the three missions that the Lord gave to Elijah.
Yep.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Yeah. To appoint Hazael over Aram.
Yeah. Which he successfully does, even though it seems like he knows that's going to go poorly for Israel.
Yeah, and you're like, the Lord has weird goals.
Yeah.
Because Hazael doesn't turn out well for Israel or Judah, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We have this guy, is it Jehoram? Is that the king that we're on now? Oh man, this was so confusing.
Oh. This is why I stopped naming people.
The fifth year of King Joram, son of Ahab of Israel, Jehoram, son of King Jehoshaphat of Judah, began to reign. And he's portrayed as being good, but this is another one of the ones where like he just sort of randomly loses stuff, I think.
Yeah, so Edom rebels. When we saw the three kings go out, right? Like Judah is a vassal of Israel, but Edom is a vassal of Judah. And now Edom runs away.
Yeah. And Libna. But we get less detail there. Is it Libna? Yeah. And we just sort of wait. I mean, this whole section is just kind of one thing after another. One miracle mm-hmm. after another, one like political note after another. So now we have Ahaziah and Joram attacking Hazael, the one that Elisha installed.
Get wounded.
Yeah, they get wounded. And while the king is wounded, Elisha engineers another coup.
Yeah, which, remember, is the Lord's second mission
that he gave to Elijah. I was guessing that.
Anoint Jehu as king. And then we basically get two chapters of slaughter.
Yeah.
Some of it more efficient than others.
Yeah, so Jehu goes crazy consolidating his own power by killing all of Ahab's descendants, except he misses one, we're going to find out, right?
Yeah.
And killing all the prophets of Baal and all the worshippers of Baal.
And Jezebel.
And mm-hmm. Jezebel.
Yeah.
I was particularly disturbed by the massacre of the worshippers of Baal. I mean, what a dirty, dirty trick.
Oh, yeah.
Sells them all to come for like a feast, pretends like he's in on it, and then slaughters them all.
Which is, I mean, there are so many weird things here. Like, first of all, he's violating hospitality norms.
Yeah.
Which we've seen elsewhere is like, don't do that.
Yeah. Like, not to mention bearing false witness or.
Yeah. And then at the end of all of this, the narrator is still such a bummer about Jehu.
What do you mean?
Like, so at the end of, let's see, 10, because it's just slaughter, slaughter, slaughter. 31 of 10. But Jehu was not careful to follow the law of the Lord, the God of Israel, with all his heart. He did not turn from the sins of Jeroboam, which he caused Israel to commit. And it's just like, oh.
And according to my footnote, that's that he worshipped in places that weren't Jerusalem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, that's the thing.
Yeah, so the narrator still is just like, still not a good king.
What's so disturbing, though, because the narrator says that, but then if you back up a few verses in verse 30, the Lord said to Jehu, because you have done well in carrying out what I consider right, and in accordance with all that was in my heart, have dealt with the house of Ahab, your sons of the fourth generation shall sit on the throne of Israel. So it's disturbing, like, all this massacre, God responds by saying it was what was in his heart.
But it only buys you four generations.
But it only buys you four generations, and because you miss these other peccadilloes down here, like...
Yeah.
It's just, again, sort of in tension with itself, and deeply in tension with any ideas I have about God.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So then we get this, like, break in the Davidic dynasty in Judah, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
Athaliah.
Sort of, right? Like, she is a break, but she's married to someone who is Davidic. It's just so goofy.
Yeah.
But she's a girl, so she doesn't count.
I mean, like, if you look at the list of the kings of Judah, she is on it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's just, like, we don't learn much about her.
Yeah.
First time. Brand new information. Had to reread the paragraph. Wait a second, what?
Yeah, so... Athaliah kills people, including her own, like, descendants. The whole thing is weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I had a hard time tracking descendants. Like, I kept thinking, wait, is this the... Because the names were so similar from mm-hmm. Judah and Israel, I kept thinking, like, is this Israel killing people in Judah, or is this within Judah? Or... It got really confusing.
Yeah. But... So there is something cool here. And I want to point it out to you because this is another place where we look behind the curtain a little bit. And this is a little harder to notice than the previous one where there was just like a grapefruit-sized hole in the stucco, right? So you'll notice that. So just very briefly, Jehosheba hides Jehoash, okay? Same name. And so that's the son of Ahaziah, right? Now you'll notice that he is how old? 7 years old. When Athaliah is deposed and he begins to rule, which when anytime we see like a kid propelled into power through a bloody insurrection, it probably is telling us something that it doesn't actually want to tell us. And it actually does get into that. So let's go to, this is chapter 11, verse 13. So Athaliah hears the noise, right? And she runs and the king, and who does she see? She sees the conspirators who are removing her from power to put this child there. When she looked, there was the king, who is seven, keep that in mind,
yeah.
Standing by the pillar according to custom. Now, who is with him? The captains and the trumpeters beside the king, and all the people of the land rejoicing and blowing trumpets. That euphemism, people of the land, is the landed aristocracy.
Oh.
So who is standing lord over this transfer of power? But the same landed aristocracy that we've seen fingerprints of elsewhere, who are very self-interested, are always trying to manipulate what the religious class is doing. And here they are written directly into the narrative, whereas usually they are not quite so directly placed into the narrative. They're there.
Yeah, and it totally makes sense that they could engineer something like this.
Yeah.
If someone was unpopular enough for them all to come together.
Yeah, and usually that's
even how, like, in the Middle Ages, the nobles are strong enough to depose the king if they all want to.
Yeah, and that's what's happening here is we get the sense that Athaliah, maybe because she's a woman, is just unpopular enough. Basically, in every time period ever, the aristocracy, the landed nobility, could absolutely beat the king.
Right.
There's 200 of them for every king.
Right.
But what does the king do? Does everything in his power, or in this case, her power, to divide their interests. Well, that's not happening here. So who do they put on the throne? A seven-year-old child. There's a lot of clues here that this is just a transfer of power to a puppet.
Yeah.
Anyway, Jehoash, his name kind of switches again, but it is the same boy.
Yeah,
it's confusing. Is kind of going to not really seem all that effective, right? So he does do these temple repairs, which first of all, might actually fit into the arrangement that's going on behind the scenes. That the priestly class and the landed aristocracy are getting together and they're like, you know what, instead of being used for whatever these goofy royals want to use money for, let's use it for the maintenance.
Yeah.
Right. And so suddenly we get this really in-depth story that the best thing that Jehoash does is basically let the temple money be used for repairs.
Yeah.
And it's like this weird involved story. And we're reading it and we're like, why do these details matter? Well, it might be because really this is the fulfillment of the backroom deal that the people of the land and the priests are doing in order to, this is their cooperation, is using royal funds in a way that suits them better.
Yeah.
And then we just get, and then King Hazael is there. And what is he doing? Well, he's hassling them. And so Jehoash has to pay him off to not ransack Jerusalem. So not a very effective king.
Right. And he pays him off quickly, too. I mean, there's a sense of like, oh, yeah, take it.
Yeah. takes these temple gifts and just like, oh, go away.
And then he's murdered.
And then he dies in some kind of conspiracy. Yeah.
Yeah.
My footnotes note that there's a different way he dies in Chronicles. We're going to have to do this all again. I'm not sure I feel about that.
Maybe we'll skip Chronicles. Do you want to read more propaganda? I don't know.
Well, I'm kind of curious how the propaganda slants differently. Maybe what we should do is just make Andrew do all the work. Let's have one episode where he just lectures on Chronicles. Because that's all I really want.
Oh, boy.
You do the lecture, I'll bring the cookies.
All right, well, I'll think of that. sounds like a lot of work.
Yeah,
no, there's two Chronicles.
I know.
Do we just want to take a month off to do all of our Chronicle reading, and then you can do the lecture, but we'll just have,
I'm like, okay, everyone take a month to read Chronicles and just list all the differences that come to mind. That'll be our whole episode.
So then we have Jehoahaz. And this is, I wrote this all. I tried to, he succeeds Jehu, Jehu, right? So we're back to Israel now.
Yes, we're up in Israel.
So we're back to Israel now with Jehoahaz. And I mean, again, we just have this tension where God's like both happy with Jehoahaz and mad at the same time.
Yeah, like, so the troubles that they're facing are pitched kind of as divine punishment. But like, it's Elisha's fault, right? He's the one who put Hazael on the throne.
Right.
So it's like, well, that doesn't sound like a divine punishment so much as just like more politics.
Yeah. Do we believe that the book of the annals of the king of Israel is made up?
You know, we don't know, but and people sometimes, like we've seen places like the Acts of King Solomon where people think there might have been a courtly record. Because that would be a normal thing to write, right? Mm-hmm. Like, basically, the achievements of a king. But we really don't know. So, like, some of this stuff may not pass the smell test, depending on the person reading it.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's like, in the Lord of the Rings, where Tolkien talks about, and of course, that book that so-and-so wrote that, you know,
yeah.
I'll write at some point.
Yeah, it could be that. I mean, we are kind of into, like, so, like, historians don't agree on whether David existed, but now we're into the period where people are like, yeah, it does seem like there were two kingdoms that really didn't like each other and had a bunch of kings with J in their name.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
and went back and forth on who was a vassal to who.
Yeah, and, like, things like that. And, like, we have plenty of material evidence now, like the Black Obelisk and the Tel Dan Stele. Like, we have all of this stuff that kind of refers to this time period. And we've talked about the Mesha Stele.
Mm-hmm.
Mesha gets name dropped in here. Now, is it the same Mesha? Well, it's, you know, Mesha of Moab. I mean, you kind of get the sense that it's in the right place. So we can't know. And it's being filtered through so many layers of redaction that, you know, feel free to doubt any individual thing. But at the same time, like, some of these really do pass, like, history smell checks, like some of them.
Yeah.
Like them losing all the time.
Yeah.
Like that seems like, you know, that's not very flattering. So which one are you referring to? Because one of them, I really was like, I don't know if this guy had a courtly record.
Well, just that, like, it keeps getting repeated over and over with the various and assorted kings where you have, like, you talk about them for a paragraph. And it just popped out again in, like, 13:8. Now, did the acts of Jehoahaz and all that he did, including his might, are they not written in the book of the annals of the king of Israel? And, like, they've talked about that book over and over and over again.
Yeah, I really don't know about that. Like, some of the individual books where it's like, and he had an annals of his court. Like, those all would have existed, but they would have just been, like, lists, right? Like, and then in this summer of this year, the third year of his reign, he, like, gave some money to farmers. Like, it would have been that, and no one wanted to read it.
Mm-hmm. And probably exaggerated lists like the steles we have now.
Yeah.
Totally wiped those other guys out.
Yeah. And all the farmers loved him, and you're like, well, then he got killed by, like, landowners. So... There's good reason to be skeptical. So I don't know. It would be a heck of a find.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd love to read that list now. Yeah. Or actually, let's be honest. I'd love to have some historian read that list and summarize it for me.
Yeah.
I would love to read the Wikipedia page. Yeah, about
exactly.
It.
I mean, it's kind of like with stele, right? Like, it's super fun to know that the stele are there and that someone has read them. And can tell you what they are.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, some of these are just so incredible. Like, here's the black obelisk of Shalmaneser III. This is some corroborating evidence. It's in the British Museum, because everything is.
Yep.
And this, it refers to either Jehu or Jehoram.
Hmm.
And so this is from probably 800s BCE. And yeah, you can go see it in the British Museum. The inscription is intact. It talks about Jehu. So we do have some corroborating evidence that is extra biblical, which is really, that's where you get bullseyes. But none of it attests to, like, any of Elisha or any of that stuff, right?
What does it say about Jehu, that stele, do you know?
So it shows a figure who is identified as Jehu, son of Omri. So a member of the Omrite dynasty, and he is bowing before Shalmaneser III, which would make sense because we know that the Assyrian polity up there is too big for these people to fight with, so they are a client state of Assyria. And all of these little squabbles are basically just squabbles between vassals to Assyria. Mm. You know, they don't really care about them. They're just vassals poking each other, and iron sharpens iron, you know, keep them sharp.
Yeah, keep them divided, just like the nobles.
Exactly, keep them divided. So we do have this, and it's from northern Iraq. It's from the right place. It's been dated to about the right time. So you can see, I'll show you the picture. So it's exactly where you would expect, which is northeast of Israel. And there it is. And so we have Jehu attested to. Does that mean it's the same Jehu? Well, as we've seen, there's a lot of Jehus, a lot of Jehoashes, Joashes. But it's kind of in the right place at the right time, and it attests to the political situation that we would expect.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So under Jehoahaz, they get some sort of reprieve. It says there's like a savior sent.
yeah, tell us more.
That's about all I know.
I know. I'm saying it to the...
I was like, what did I miss?
to the redactor is, it uses language like we saw in Judges, this idea of an anointed or a judge being raised up to do something, but it doesn't deign to, like, tell us any details.
Yeah.
Well, and it just again, it's another place where it feels like the narrative's in tension with itself, because it's making Jehoahaz out to be, like, super bad. He did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, followed the sins of Jeroboam. Oh, but by the way, like, they were delivered, and you can read about his might in this book. It just feels in tension with itself again. And then we get the end of Elisha, and we're back to Jehu, right? We're back to Jehu? No, which one are we back to? Joash.
Jehoash, who after he dies shows up again, and we'll get another death scene in a couple chapters.
For Jehoash?
Yeah.
Oh.
And... like, it seems like the whoever is redacting this really stumbled because they killed the guy. Bring him back. He's going to die later. But we get the whole, like, shooting arrows thing. And
yeah, so Elijah predicts that they're going to beat the Arameans. He says, hit the ground with the arrow. He does it three times. And Elisha says, you should have struck five or six times. Then you would have struck down Aram until you made an end of it. But now you will strike down Aram only three times. Verse 19. Again, I just don't know what to make of this stuff.
It's like you're playing a game with someone and they just keep changing the rules.
Like, it's like when I was in fourth grade and like the kids would like to tease me when I'd like finally break down and cry, they'd be like, if you'd made it five more minutes, then we would have stopped teasing you.
Yeah, exactly. And Elisha's bones can bring back the dead.
Oh, yeah. That was interesting.
That's fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's the end.
One wonders how useful that is, because this marauding band kills the guy, throws him into the pit, he comes back to life, and presumably the marauding band is like, we'll kill him again.
Yeah, maybe.
Also, why is the grave of Elisha just open and unguarded?
I got the sense that it was like happening while they were burying him. I don't know. It was. I agree, though. That's how I made it fit in my head.
Yeah, kind of weird.
They're like in the middle of it, and then these marauders showed up.
Yeah. Well, thank you for joining us this week.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for listening to the Third Hour Podcast. Join us again next week. When honestly, I have no idea what we're going to be talking about. That'll be wild. But it's going to be awesome.
Thank you for joining us. This was the Third Hour, a Latter-day Saint home study podcast. If you felt any impressions or had any comments, we would love to hear them at thethirdhourpodcast.com. We'll see you next time.